Before we get started with today's show, I wanted to tell you about another great ESPN podcast, Black History Always. Black History Always is a new podcast in partnership with The Undefeated that takes a deep dive into the stories of now and tomorrow from a black aperture that will empower and inspire. Hosted by Clinton Yates, rate, review, and follow Black History Always. Also, ESPN Plus subscribers, join an ESPN Plus Fantasy Football League now for a chance to win $250,000. Sweepstakes is U.S. only, 18 or older, no purchase necessary. Visit ESPN.com/ESPN Plus football rules for full details and official rules. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. Coming up on this episode of The Right Time, we have got an interview with comedian Anthony Jeselnik. Really good. Check this out. But first,
welcome to the Right Time Charity Trivia Tournament. There are two contestants. They get 5 questions apiece. Each of them gets 1 lifeline where they can make the question multiple choice. Let's meet today's contestants. First, we got the disaster from Nebraska, the gangster nerd herself, Mina Kimes. You know that Mina was supposed to be salutatorian. However, she is a gangster nerd, so she bullied some poor defenseless girl into allowing her to be the valedictorian in her school. I mean, it's close
That's
enough.
That's not how it went down. That's
Wait
not,
a minute.
Not
how many people were in this class? How many people were in this class?
So before it we smells know, like hate. Hate. That smells like hate. That's a question.
Yeah, it does.
The premise of that question is this: Joel Anderson.
Are we talking about 5A school?
We haven't introduced you yet. You already hating.
And we just gonna act like he didn't say salutatorian. Okay, cool. All good.
Oh.
He's a professional
football
TV
player.
So I didn't
salutatorian? Did I say salutatorian?
That's, you said salutatorian.
That sounds like a porn name, by the way.
It does. Yes, it does. I feel so much better that you said that and not me.
Yeah. We were all thinking it. First of all, it was a big class. It was over 1,000 people. I went to like a giant high school. So
take
eat that, Joel. And also, okay. We were co-valedictorian. I can't believe I'm revisiting this. We were co-valedictorians. And then I figured out that if I took a computer test instead of taking computers, I would win on a technicality because my GPA wouldn't be diluted. And the school said
gangsta
that's
nerd.
Not cool.
Nobody's judging you for it. We're just pointing out that I was a gangster nerd move.
I mean, look at that.
Salutatorian.
Look at that effort, man.
I just want to say that I thought when my TV show got canceled, I wouldn't have to hear no stuff like this ever again.
Yeah, you invited me on this.
Wow.
All right. Wow. She's going up against a man.
I didn't raise it. I didn't bring it.
You did not. It's not your fault. It's not your fault.
All right. So she is going against the only man who has a slow burn that you want to catch, Joel Anderson.
Ooh,
that was good. You like that?
I like that.
Yeah,
I like
was that.
Yeah,
wow.
You come on and read some ads for us. You know,
wow.
We can work out something. We can't afford you, but you know, maybe you
Yo,
can come over.
You're the only person so far he's done an intro for that wasn't insulted in some form or fashion.
I am honored too.
What?
That is true.
But Monty, your intro was such a compliment. There is no one
actually that's true
who has ever defeated a receding hairline except for you. You're the only person in the world.
That's fair. That's fair. You said I came back with 3-1 against Matt Pattern Ball, and as you're right, that was actually my bad.
That's really good.
Right. It really was.
Up first.
Well, hold on. Who are they playing for in our charity tournament?
Not a very good host. Yes, the proceeds. Who are they going to for you, Mina?
The Los Angeles City Food Bank.
Awesome. Joel?
The Southern Center for Human Rights.
Perfect. All right. Mina, are you ready now?
So this isn't timed, right?
No, it's not timed, but I mean, it is a podcast.
I just want to hit me. All right.
So competitive.
By the way, I'm trying to do a preamble or anything, but I expect to lose. Okay.
Oh, thank God.
This is, like I said, look at the Lou Holtz over here. You know what I'm saying? I don't know how we're going to block the Bowling Green front four.
Oh, gosh. All right, Mina. Which U.S. holiday weekend historically features the running of the Indianapolis 500 auto race?
Memorial Day.
Oh, that was quick. Confident.
Easy. Are they all this easy?
Y'all wasn't asking no shit like that when I had to answer the questions.
All right. I'm going to pretend like I didn't hear it. Question number two. Which college men's basketball team has won the second most NCAA championships?
Second most? I assume. Is it Kentucky?
2-0. Well done.
Man, that was such a good guess. Oh,
that was a good guess.
That was cheating.
You still
game cheating.
Remember, you still have your lifeline in your pocket. Questions should get more difficult. All right. Which defensive end retired in 2003 as the NFL's all-time sack leader with 200 career sacks?
Oh, come on, man. That's just too easy. That's not fair. Oh, man, game is cheating, bro.
All right, we'll see. Game, we'll see.
It'll see. Anyway.
2003 all-time sack leader defensive end. I think I know who it is, but I'm going to use my lifeline on this one.
Okay.
I don't want to get the football one wrong.
We got...
Joel, shut up.
We got Richard Dent, Bruce Smith, Kevin Green, Reggie White. So you want to walk through your thought process for us, or you just want the listeners to deal with this dead air? What you think, Mina?
I want to answer first so she gets it right.
Okay, you can answer it after her.
You can answer it after me. I think it's either Smith or White. 2003 would be Reggie White? No, Bruce Smith! Bruce Smith!
No.
Sorry. It is Bruce Smith. Well done. Mina,
it worked out okay because I was getting ready to say it was the only one of them who was alive in 2003, but Reggie White did not pass away until 2004.
Oh, man. Now that was completely unnecessary. That is just you flexing.
That was
questions that you are not even involved in. Which player both set and then tied his own NCAA record for most steals in a single game, nabbing 13 twice?
A single game.
Yes. Would you like me to read it again, or you feel good about it?
Yeah, read it one more time. Yeah.
All right. Which player both set and then tied his own NCAA record for most steals in a single game, nabbing 13 twice?
College, I have no idea.
Tony Gwynn? What's Tony Gwynn?
Kenny Lofton?
No. Let me read the question one more time to make it a little clearer and add some more context.
Is it a basketball? Oh, yeah. God.
Which both set.
Oh, then I definitely have no idea. Yeah, no idea. No idea.
Okay. You want to guess, Joel? Anybody got something?
No. Nah.
Both steals. I don't know. Greg Anthony?
Mookie Blaylock.
Okay,
All right, man, it's your last question. This one is rated hard. Which college team?
What was the last one rated? That was a $50 jawbreaker right there.
That last one was rated medium. So, I mean, if you got issues, take it up with Gabe.
I should have gotten Bruce Smith. All right.
Here we go. Which college team scored a perfect 12 for 12 for three in a single game in 2012? Which college team scored a perfect 12 for 12 for three in a single game in 2012?
Villanova?
Indiana State.
Yeah.
Yo, it feels like the trivia guys just punished Mina for that Bruce Smith thing.
That was so stupid, so obvious.
I've not heard of Indiana State's basketball.
We've officially got worst case scenario. Mina being hard on herself. No. This isn't a real competition, except for me.
Yeah, they're all real competitions to Mina.
I'm glad. You know what? I wanted to lose, so the worst would be advancing.
Let's just wait.
Let's not give Joel too much credit here.
The good thing about going up against Joel is, like, I knew if I lose, he would be cool. Like, I didn't want to go up against Nick Wright, for example, and lose. No, this is a compliment to Joel because Joel's nice.
It's not a compliment. You're seeding the ground is what you're doing. We all see what you're doing. You're just making sure that if you tell him how nice he is, he can't roast you. But I'm going to roast you on his behalf if he is not going to do it.
and by the way, you would have wanted to go against Nick Wright because he lost and he played it well, but there was salt.
He was
salt was
present. I mean, I got something to say about Nick. I mean, come on, bro. You root for the Chiefs. And you know Qualcomm Stadium or Jack Murphy Stadium? I'm like, how did you? Ooh. Anyway, yeah, we're going to have to go there.
Yeah, no. Nick leaned all the way out on his ancestry and don't know nothing about baseball.
Which NHL team is based in Toronto, Canada?
Oh, Maple Leaf.
Ding. Well done, sir.
When I was on here, y'all was asking me about the veins on the leaf.
You happen to know, Joel, or were you listening to that episode? Do you know what the veins on the Maple Leaf represent? 13 veins.
Oh, what?
Logo. There are 13 Stanley Cups. Of note, it's been the same since 1964, I believe, is the last time they won one.
Oh, man.
That's karma on them. They must have not integrated earlier.
Who was the first player to play in the NBA during four different decades?
Okay. Let's see. Wait a minute. Hold on. Oh, man.
Who has had
a let me get a lifeline.
Okay, lifeline. Lifeline, we got Vince Carter, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Kevin Garnett, Kobe Bryant. Using a lifeline on the easy question. Interesting strategy, Joel.
Easy? Wait a minute.
Question is rated as easy. These two are rated as easy.
Is it?
The next two are medium.
Is it saying shit about them veins?
Oh, Vince Carter.
Yep. Tied up. All right. You got three to go to take the lead.
Like 300 years.
I had to tie it up. I at least wanted to get that done. Now I can focus on your thing.
No lifelines left.
No lifelines. We might be going to a tiebreaker. We'll see.
Ugh, brutal.
Which quarterback started and won Super Bowl 35 in 2001, only to be released during the offseason?
Oh, 2001.
Yes, 2001.
Okay. It would be Trent Dilfer.
For the win.
Yeah. Oh, 3 for 3, dog. What's up, boy? I know I went to a tier 3 university, but that's all right. You know what I'm saying?
Keep going, though. He might mess up and get him negative.
Here we go.
Nah, stop it.
Yo, I mean.
Why I got to keep going?
You don't have to.
What happened?
I mean, I just for.
Nah, keep going. I want to see what the hard ones were. Yeah. Because those three were easy.
Nah, LC, that got easy because I answered them. Okay, I see how it's going to go. All right.
Which WNBA, which WNBA player was the first to be named a league MVP for two different teams?
I think I know.
All
right.
I know, too.
Lisa Leslie?
Anybody want to take a guess?
No. I'm going to take a guess. I believe it's a woman that I saw walking through the mall in Durham in 2006. And somebody called and told me that she was with a dude that played for one of the local college teams, and we just could not believe it. Is the answer Candace Parker?
Oh, no. I know who it is.
I wonder
is.
How old Elena Deladon was in 2006. Was she even alive yet? Because that is the correct answer.
Oh, my bad.
I know who he was going to talk about, though. You just wanted to talk nasty about Sheldon Williams. I didn't know what that's about.
I don't even. Oh, that's
you
what that
talk
was?
Dirty about.
That, I didn't think you needed to point that part out. The joke was better if we left it unsaid. I was simply surprised.
I told y'all not to give me another question.
All right.
Keep going.
Which MLB legend had a .367 batting average across a 24-year playing career that ended in 1928?
That's way too easy.
Not for me.
What?
1920.
I will give you a hint. Nah, no hints.
Yeah, I was going to give him a very simple
Joel,
hint.
Joel, can you name another baseball player pre-1940 other than Honus Wagner?
The cool Papa Bell played before then?
He played, but he didn't play in the league we're discussing.
Wait a minute, was probably somebody named Oil Cannon?
I give you a hint. I give you a hint. He probably was rooting for Mina in this competition.
Oh.
That hint would not help me at all.
Why is it just like a notorious horn dog?
Probably really rooting for Mina in this one.
Oh, Taka.
There you
well
go.
Well done.
Yeah, okay.
Well done. Teamwork makes the dream work.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I was like, nah, I get it. I was like, okay.
That's now I can name two baseball players.
I only know this because Ty Cobb.
On TV, you know? Yeah,
Ty Cobb is the all. Right, he has the highest batting average ever at .367.
It's impressive. I mean, 24 years, only white people in the league at that point. So I mean,
yeah, I forgot the cool Papa Bell. My bad, cool Papa Bell.
Well, not only.
The
I mean,
of the Major League Baseball.
They thought it was That's only fair. White people.
I mean,
in
Babe
the
Ruth was playing, but.
I'm just saying.
He was playing, but he was out there passing.
If I showed you a picture of what could pass for black in that day and age and then showed you a picture of Babe Ruth.
Yeah.
I'll tell you this, if Babe Ruth was hitting 230, they'd have said he was black.
He'd been down there playing with the Indianapolis Clowns. Yeah.
the fat monarch.
Anyway, it's been another.
I made a mistake, man. Y'all made a mistake, man.
What was
y'all
the mistake?
Amina is a ratings generator, man. Y'all should put her against somebody easy, but y'all thought I was a game. You know what I'm saying?
That's oh,
you
think oh, we that's fixed what the this tournament? Is.
Knocked out the first
we
round.
We fixed the so, tournament.
So you're saying that this is you got the 16 seed versus like the one seed because they wanted you to advance.
This is Hampton versus Iowa State.
There's gonna be some fights in the conference room after this. We're gonna be very upset with whoever made the brackets. Because Joel Anderson is moving forward. Anyway.
I'm not complaining.
Who does Joel Anderson face next?
That's a good question.
I think I know. No, I'm on the other side of the bracket. Joel will face the winner of Spencer Hall and Howard Bryant. Oh.
Okay.
That's a guaranteed L, my friend.
Two guys who are going to act like they don't care, but once it gets started, they damn sure will.
I put money on Howard to win the whole thing, other than Bo. This is what, if I had to choose one.
Y'all
guy.
Keep doing that. Y'all
thank
keep
you for
doing
that other than right. Bo part. Thank you so much. Because I've had so many that. People not thinking that I'm going to win this, and I began to take it personal.
Oh, Lord.
You know?
Well, how do you think if you're not a single person in the world?
Hold on a second, Joe. Did you just Michael Jordan us? I think you just Michael Jordan. Then you hit us with the Jordan shrug.
Yeah, he's
not.
No,
that's
personal.
Not the Jordan shrug.
Oh, yeah, that's my
that's
bad.
That's the white man security guard shrug.
Yeah, right.
You did the Jerry Curl white man shrug.
Down at the yes. That's me.
Yes.
Pitching quarters at a wall. All right. Well, I think there is more show to come. It won't have me in it or Mina, but it'll still be fantastic. Joel Anderson will be back in a couple of weeks to lose to probably.
Okay. Y'all keep doing that. Y'all keep doing it. That's fine. Y'all keep going. Y'all keep doubting.
Guys, stop doing this. We believe. Stop doing this. This man ain't accomplished nothing to brag about since he was 10 years old. You know what I'm saying?
All right.
And so now he has something else to hold up.
I just want some credit for when I introduced you. I did not mock you about that because, of course, when I sat down this morning to write my introductions, the first thing that came to mind is that
he'd be thrilled. He's thrilled anytime, even if you bring it up in a mocking context. He's delighted.
I mean, that's why I keep bringing it up. But, you know, if you want to get real about it, I mean, I did win my school spelling bee the next year. You know what I'm saying? So I did accomplish something else after that. So, I mean, now what? You feel silly. You thought my career ended in 88?
I did not.
Like, you didn't think about it.
I actually think the things that you've done recently are far more impressive than either of those. Sadly, I just think being a fast 10-year-old is worthless.
What?
Hey. We like what we like.
I appreciate Fox saying that because that's still a sort of a compliment because that speaks very well of the work I've done. I mean, if y'all have been the fastest 10-year-old in the country, y'all would be talking about it too.
No.
No, nobody would.
Maybe not. Maybe not Fox.
That's a good place to wrap. All right, joining us now, I don't even really know the best introduction to give for our guest other than he is hilariously mean. When you have a TV show called The Offensive, the Jeselnik Offensive, which is on Comedy Central, that I just remember watching and seeing some horrifying joke on Casey Anthony that was the funniest thing I had ever seen at the time. Anthony Jeselnik, what's going on, man?
Not much, man. Good to see you.
Likewise, man. Now, you are from Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
Jeselnik has a very Pittsburgh-y vibe. What is it? The Yinzers? Is that the term that is used for the locals?
People throw around Yinzers, yeah. And if I ever said Yinz growing up in the house, my parents stopped that real quick.
Really?
They said, yeah, you're not going to be a Yinzer. We were kind of in the suburbs, and I wasn't going to be a Yinzer.
Oh, you're a little too bougie for that?
Mm-hmm. My parents thought so, for sure.
Now, like, Pittsburgh's one of those interesting cities for me where I realized that I don't know that many people who are from there. And so my introduction to Pittsburgh has been largely through social media, which is the wrong way to learn about any place.
Mm-hmm.
We just get your caricatures.
It's a great city. It's a big drinking town. Big drinking town where they're like trying to stop new bars from opening. It's gotten so bad. And everyone, they only really care about the Steelers. Mm-hmm. And that's it. It's become a little more of a hockey town, which I like. And the Pirate Stadium is beautiful. The team is not. But good people. You know, I always say I would move back there one day if my sisters didn't live there.
Well, I'm also trying to imagine, though, for you, that going from Pittsburgh and then going to college in New Orleans, which is, there's no place in America like New Orleans. Like, the only places that are like New Orleans are in France. And I realized that when I went to France, it was like, oh, so New Orleans makes a little bit of sense. That's why you guys don't really work very hard and just kind of just chill around and eat and drink all day long. Oh, okay, cool. This is the point of origin. Like, I could imagine that for you showing up there and just being like, oh, yo, this is different.
Oh, completely. And I had never even visited New Orleans before my first day of school. Mm-hmm. And you think like, oh, New Orleans is the deep South. It's not. It's its own world down there. That 4 years of college there was the, you know, the best time of my life, to be quite honest.
How long was it before you made your first wrong turn and realized that the worst of New Orleans is literally the worst of the United States of America?
You know, being a Tulane student, being like right on St. Charles and not having a car, you know, I wasn't that adventurous. You know, I kind of just went to the bars my friends took me to and was a little more, sheltered than most people. Like, you would get arrested where the cops would come up to you and you'd just say, I'm a Tulane student. And that would work half the time.
No, St. Charles is the street for me where you could definitely just be like, oh, wow, look at these wonderful garden homes. And then you make a right and be like, hey, can we go back to the main drag, please? Because this is not what I signed up for.
Yeah, didn't end up in the bad parts a lot, but my brother went to Tulane years afterwards, and it was after Katrina, and he would have to go through the worst of the worst neighborhoods, canvassing door to door, trying to get people help with monetary stuff and housing stuff. That would have been the scariest thing of my life.
Yeah, but see, they ain't gonna do nothing to you. Like, something happened to me, ain't nobody coming to come look for me. If we get a dead Jeselnik on the street in New Orleans, it'll be some APBs and everything else coming around to make sure that such a thing does not happen. I have made frantic U-turns in New Orleans. I have done things in New Orleans where I'm just like, what is this? And I love the place. I always say there's two ways to look at it. It would be awesome if it weren't so awful, or it would be awful if it weren't so awesome. It just depends on what your perspective happens to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I wanted to have you on because I really, really think the stuff you do is just like so funny. It's just so interesting to me that like I watched one of the last Netflix specials that you had done. And it's very interesting the moments where you wind up smiling, knowing that you're about to deliver like some first class, just mean asshole stuff. But it's too funny to not like laugh on the front end. Like, how do you like that style of comedy? How do you develop and decide that that's the approach that you want to go with?
You know, early on, I just wasn't very good, but I wanted to be. I hated those first couple years of you're very green and you're nervous, so I became more deadpan. And a lot of people were doing similar stuff in comedy, and I thought that if I could just tell jokes, because when you're doing open mics and you're starting out, you get 5 minutes of stage time, and that was it. But you could write all day long. And I thought, what if I create this character where the jokes are so good that even if you don't like me, you know, and me at 23 going on stage, I was unlikable right away. The audience was like, who is this kid? That I thought, let me be the villain and let me just make the jokes have to be so good that I can't just coast on charisma. And that served me well.
I guess I had not quite thought about what it had to be like early, because I am amazed at comedians being willing to push through. Like, speaking in front of crowds, I can do microphones, I can do cameras. Once I got to see your face when I say something, like, I've never felt more uncomfortable in my life than speaking at an eighth grade graduation, because those kids didn't think anything I said was funny or interesting or anything else. And I have to look at them and I'm literally sweating, right? Like, these are things that people who know me cannot fathom or imagine. And so, like, I can't imagine what it's like pushing through as a young comedian, like getting the confidence to do this.
Honestly, you have to be stupid. You have to be like dumb enough when you're 23. Like, I could not have started at 33. You had to be dumb enough that you were not only just doing this and putting yourself through this misery in open mics, they're not good crowds, but also you're not getting paid. You're not making any money doing this, and you have to be okay with that for 5-6 years before you really start making money. But I did the thing. I went and talked to my former high school. And, you know, a lot of the anger that I had becoming a comedian was like the way I was treated in high school and the way I was treated as a kid, because, you know, all the things that I'm known for now were things I got yelled at for in school. So they offered me an award. They said, you're going to be in an alumni award. And I was thrilled. I was like, this is like them admitting they were wrong. And I came back and they said, do you want to talk to the students? We're going to fill the auditorium, have them all come in. And I was like, this will be the best. I love this. And they had no idea who the hell I was. Like, I was just some old guy to them. They'd never heard of my Comedy Central show. They probably didn't even watch Comedy Central. And it was just flop sweat from the beginning, where you would think I could have handled it better. They had no questions. They were just like, what is this guy doing? Why does he think he's so great?
The high school teachers, especially middle school teachers in particular, the most courageous human beings on planet Earth. That's a tough room, Jack.
Oh, yeah. Brutal. I was once a teacher's assistant at a high school for troubled kids, and I lasted a month before they fired me. They said it was like having an extra emotionally troubled teenager in the room, and I couldn't argue with them. I would try to joke around and be their friend, and they wanted nothing to do with me.
Man, I had a buddy who got that job. He's probably listening right now, where he graduated from college, wasn't quite sure what to do. He had another friend who had gone to a graduate program in education, and they said they needed black men. Like, they wanted black men there to, you know, to be representative and all of that stuff. And my man shows up, and he's like 6'3", 280, and say like, oh, we got the job for you. And so they sent him to the alternative school. And I listened every day as it just declined and declined and declined until ultimately, shall we call it a mutual parting of ways, that it was realized that he did not quite have the demeanor to handle these youngsters.
No, and it's not even his fault. It's that it's so depressing because there's no like life-changing moment. You're not saving anybody. You're just trying to get them to 18, and then they're on their own, and it's tough to get up in the morning and deal with that.
You ever talk to any of those kids that do Teach for America, and they come from their fancy schools, and they decide that they're going to save the world and do Teach for America, and then it's like 2 weeks in before they realize these kids are doomed and there's nothing I can do, right? Like, maybe if you got them in elementary school, you got a chance, but they get them at like eighth grade. Nah, you ain't turning them ships around.
Nope.
I just, every time I see that happen and then you talk to them, they're so disillusioned. Life has changed. Like, everything they thought about the world, every bit of optimism they had about America. Like, can you imagine everything that you believed in just going away all at once because you tried to help?
Oh, anytime I talk to any teacher or a doctor, they are so disillusioned. Doctors love to talk people out of becoming doctors. You know, I have friends who like were pre-med in college, and whenever we met a doctor, they would say, don't do this. Do anything else. It's a brutal job.
Man, so what are you working on now?
Right now, I'm back working on stand-up. You know, I didn't have to cancel tour dates with the pandemic. I had about 15 minutes since my last special and just took a knee for a year. I was like, well, I'm going to come out of this sane and healthy. I got a dog. I didn't try to write anything. So I'm working on stand-up now, getting up almost every night, getting the new hour together. And then hopefully by the time I have that, it takes a long time, the touring will be back to what it was. I'm not into this, I'm going to go at half capacity kind of thing, because then you're getting half the money. So if I'm going to tour, I'm going to be making it all. And working on an animated show. Right now, since the pandemic, people really want documentaries and animated shows because you can work on it even when you're separate. So working on that right now, working on the deal. Who knows what happens with that? But stand-up is my main thing. So any kind of side project, if it's interesting to me, I'll jump on. But I'm kind of one of those – I'm a tool that not everyone knows how to use, so I kind of have to do it myself. If I'm going to create something for myself, it's got to come from me. People don't really come to me and say, hey, join our party, because I don't fit in.
So I'm curious, and you say you stayed sane by not working, because I stayed sane in the pandemic by working. Like, that was the thing. My TV show had just got canceled, and so I just leaned in on doing stuff, and that is what kept me sane. What did you do in the absence of work to stay sane?
Well, I mean, I was watching, you know, ESPN during that. I was watching you guys, and I was like, they're so lucky they have this, where you have to be on camera and have to be with it for certain amounts of time, because there were months that I did not. And I was like, I'm gonna fall off here. Luckily, I have a podcast I do with my friend. I think you might know. Do you know Greg Rosenthal from the NFL Network? Yeah, he's my best friend from Tulane, and we have a podcast that kind of helped me out. You know, knowing once a week I had to go and do this and keep it together was a big help. But I was like, let me try to read. Let me try not to drink. You know, I drank the first couple of weeks because I was right about to do a TV show. I had a show called Good Talk on Comedy Central, and we were weeks away from filming. And I was not drinking, not smoking. I was in the best shape of my life. I had just ordered these custom suits that were fitted. I was so excited. And then it got shut down and then flat out canceled. That after about 2 weeks, my friends were like, we're worried about you. And then I just got a dog. That got me out of the house and kept me sane. But I read a lot, tried to watch TV, what there was of TV. But just tried to stay healthy and stay away from people. You know, a lot of people, I took this more seriously than a lot of my comedian friends.
Yeah, I felt bad for a lot of comedians. Like, anytime somebody, especially in the like deep throes of this, and people are like, oh, you're trying to do a show. Well, yes, people eat by doing shows. Like, this is what it is. And comics, like I always say, we tried to do this actually over a year ago with Anthony, and we had to cancel because he overslept. And it was so funny. You were so apologetic about oversleeping, and I was so glad to find out you didn't die. Like, when the comic doesn't show up in the morning, I'm just like, okay, is he good? Like, is this a John Belushi situation? What is going on here? It's like, oh, okay, cool. He is all right. That'll work. Like, everything is straight. But it sounds like you seem to be a bit more of an emotionally adjusted comic, because you guys are all over the place, man.
Yeah, there are definitely some crazy ones. And I've been doing this almost 20 years where I've kind of learned the rules. You know, stay away from the alcohol as much as you can. You know, don't drink on the flight just because you're in first class. That's helped me a lot. But the tough part is the adrenaline. That's, I think, what gets you. And that's what got me the day that I missed your podcast was I thought I was doing Seth Meyers at 6 o'clock at night. And I thought, oh, this will be fine. I'll go to dinner afterwards. And they made it a live episode. So I got off stage at like 2:30 in the morning and just could not get to sleep for anything. The adrenaline is really what I kind of struggle with. But, you know, it's going to be a problem. You know, I talk to a therapist and I exercise and I work on myself to make sure that I can get through this, because I've seen a lot of friends who have just fallen off for a million different reasons. But I see them all as what's the word? It's an example of something you don't want to be.
Cautionary tale.
Cautionary tales. Yes. Every time I see a cautionary tale, I jot down what they did wrong and try to keep that out of my system.
Yeah, I got on the exercise too. That was my program. Like, that's what I've been on. And it's wild now, because you talk about the custom suits. You're never going back, by the way, just so you know. Once you have the custom suits, the off the rack game becomes absolutely impossible. There's no return.
Well, I've never bought a suit in my life. Anytime if a TV show gives me the suit, then I'm very happy. And I've got some very nice suits that TV shows have given me. But the idea of walking into a store and saying, help me pick one out, it will never happen.
Nah, my brother got me on his tailor. He got a tailor that comes in from Hong Kong that obviously I've not seen in like 2 years. But I also had no reason to wear any of this stuff. But now I'm doing a little bit more. And after the exercise, I got to say, them suits is fitting a little snugger than I remember. And I mean that in a good way. I was like, okay, this is how we can chart some progress.
Yeah, that was how I knew I got through the pandemic okay, is when I finally got the suits after the pandemic, they fit. And so even though I hadn't been working out like I had been before, they still fit right, that I thought, okay, I didn't do too bad.
So with like comedy, who historically have you been into? Like if you look at the guys that are like, oh, that was who made me want to do this.
I loved all comedy when I was growing up. Like I would watch anyone that was doing stand-up. I thought they were good, but I didn't like a lot of what you had to be. You know, the guys who came out and made fun of themselves, I was never into. I really loved Stephen Wright, and I really loved Rodney Dangerfield, later on Mitch Hedberg, guys who were just like, it was the jokes that got you. And the big one for me, and I think the reason that I became as successful as I did early, every comic rips off their favorite for like the first year and then they come out of it. I ripped off a writer. I don't know if you remember, Saturday Night Live had a thing called Deep Thoughts with Jack Handy. And those to me was like, I don't know how you think of it. This is brilliant. I love those so much that I would buy all the books. And that's who I kind of ripped off when I started out. And people didn't understand that. It wasn't clear that I was doing a Hedberg or I was doing a Stephen Wright. But I really liked the joke people who seemed like they just appeared in a puff of smoke. You couldn't imagine them walking around in reality. You know, I loved guys like that.
The thing with the Jack Handy Deep Thoughts was, and you know, we're about the same age. I never thought that that was like actually his name. I thought that it was a masturbation joke. Like I saw Jack Handy, right? Like I figured that's what it was. And then as I got older, I go back and read those Deep Thoughts or watch them. And I was like, oh, this should be called Deep Thoughts by a Big Old Bag of Weed. Like at 13 years old, I couldn't quite get it. I was like, oh man, this is the highest thing I've ever seen.
Yeah. I mean, it was amazing for a writer to get his name on anything on SNL, that he was a legend there. His sketches, some of the sketches were just so absurd that he really kind of shaped the best parts of that show while he was there.
I feel like those people won the game. Like, my dream in college was actually to be a ghostwriter for rappers. I wanted all the money and none of the fame. Like, I wanted to be rich and be able to walk through the mall and nobody have any idea who it was. And that's what I mean, I don't know how rich you get writing for Saturday Night Live, but that's what I think about a guy like that, that there's got to be something cool about, like, it's an if you know situation, right? Like the people in the game know who it is, and this dude could just walk around and, you know, live.
That's honestly what I thought too. I got into stand-up in order to get a writing job, and I wanted to write for a late-night show, and I was one of the first writers hired on Late Night with Jimmy Fallon, but even before he took over The Tonight Show, and I hated it. You want that credit. I mean, you write a great joke and everyone's clapping for Jimmy Fallon. It hurts a little bit that I think that even though it seems cool to kind of have anonymity, you like having your name next to the joke.
Yeah, I'll be honest about that, too. I interviewed for a job with Jim Rome about 15 years ago, and it was going to be helping him come up with stuff, basically a writing job. And he was very transparent about the fact that I'm not looking for somebody who has designs of being on air, because you're going to want that credit. And I'm going to get the credit for it. You know, like he would give you the credit when nobody was around. Obviously, if anybody asked, he would give you the credit. But he was very aware of the fact that if you wanted the credit, that was not going to be the job. And I do remember sitting there at dinner with him where he pulled up in this incredible Ferrari. And just as he's hearing the saying that, I'm like, you know what? I really might not be right for this job now that you mentioned it.
Yeah. When I started on Fallon, it was a disaster because they would ask me to pitch a sketch idea. And I would say, okay, so I walk in the room and they'd stop me and go, wait, you mean Jimmy walks in the room? I'm like, oh, yeah, that's right. You guys don't want me in front of the camera. And I was clearly wanted to be in front of the camera that I made it a year and then went off to go be me.
And how fun was that?
It was great. It was amazing. I mean, at first it's tough because I'm touring as a headliner for the first time. And I had a little money for the first time from writing on Fallon for a year. But everywhere I went, people were just coming to see comedy. I didn't have a lot of fans. I'd put out an album recently, so some people knew, but it was always hit or miss. And then about a year after I was headlining, I did the roast of Donald Trump for Comedy Central. And that was such a big hit that the very next weekend, my life was different, where the entire club was sold out and they were all there to see me and knew what they were getting into. Because I feel like I'm a horror movie. I'm not a good special guest drop in on a show because I say if you're not paying to see me, you don't want to see me. It's you've got to really be in the mood. So that helped tremendously.
What is it like to go back and watch that Donald Trump roast now with everything that has happened since then? Because there was a time where that was just somebody that you could just come in and tell some jokes about. And now it's like, oh, no, it's a little deeper than that.
It's insane. I mean, I'm almost glad that I was able to get it out of my system before he became president. And at the time, he was talking about running for president, and none of us took it seriously at all. Not one bit. And now to go back and look at it, I still look at it as like maybe my big break, and I'm very proud of what I did. But I just remember him sitting there trying, like, not laughing at any of the jokes and not really giving anybody anything. And they had to stop the show and come up to him and say, Mr. Trump, if you laugh, we put the cameras back on you. Like, if you don't laugh at these jokes, we're just going to keep cutting to the audience. But if you're the show, if you're giving us something to shoot, and he got that right away. Like, he was very aware of how things worked once you told him. And it was actually legit funny. When he gets up at the end and does his rebuttal, it was legitimately funny and not just like they've written things for him. But I never in a million years did I think that this would happen.
Yeah, I did an interview with Ta-Nehisi Coates in April of 2016. He was just like, I'm not even talking about this, right? Like, none of us thought that this was actually going to turn into a thing that would dominate our lives for like the next, you know, 4 or 5 years. But I also imagine for you, they give you a call to be like, hey, we're doing a roast. That just feels like wheelhouse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I had gotten in stand-up thinking that I wanted to become a roaster eventually. And at the time, they were huge. It was like the Super Bowl of comedy. Even if you didn't watch stand-up, you would go watch those. And I got lucky, and I wrote for David Hasselhoff, and they liked my stuff enough, and my star was rising. They put me on Trump, and Trump was the best because you could not make people feel bad for him. No matter what you said, you could say the worst thing in the world, and it would not really hurt him or make people feel bad. That, like, I roasted Charlie Sheen on the next roast, and Mike Tyson was on the dais. And I legitimately felt bad making fun of Mike Tyson. Like, I love Mike Tyson, and he deserves some ribbing. But the guy was going through stuff, and I felt bad having to kick him while he was down.
Was this in the run where every roaster was obligated to tell some joke about Lisa Lampanelli dating black dudes?
This was the last roast Lampanelli did was the Trump roast. And I remember I was very aware of that. Like, everyone kind of piled on her and was so, so mean to her that my joke for her was I was really mean to everyone else. And then when I got to Lampanelli, I just said, Lisa Lampanelli, you're cool. And then just moved on and just ignored her completely. And we've been best friends ever since then because she was so happy that someone didn't just trash her.
It's so funny because I did not know anything about her until watching those roasts. I think the Flavor Flav roast was the first one that I had seen. And everybody had the same joke where Ice-T said something about he was the only black dude in the room who had not had sex with Lisa Lampanelli. Then he admitted, I tried, but it was so many, shall we say, black men in there that the fire marshal was turning them away. And I was just like, yo, I feel like I should know more about this person before I start laughing about all of this.
And honestly, it was all made up. Like, I don't know. I mean, she was married to a white guy at the time. That, like, they would just find something for you, and that would be your thing. It's just like a bunch of comedy writers trying to find the angle. And they're like, okay, Lisa Lampanelli, like, sleeps with a lot of black guys. That's going to be the thing. And it, even though it had no, like, basis in reality, they just ran with it, and people thought that was the truth.
So have you been getting back into the clubs now, or is it just, like, getting into the plan of getting there?
A little bit. As soon as I got vaccinated, I avoided outdoor shows. I didn't do any Zoom shows during the pandemic. But once I got vaccinated, I started doing an outdoor show at this place called The Whitley in Hollywood that does shows almost every night. It's in the round. It's outside. It's great. Great performers. And then when the Comedy Store came back, I've started going back there. And then there's a club called Largo, which is one of my favorite. It's like a theater in the city that does a few shows a week. And now that they're back, I kind of go between those three. So I'm always working on new jokes. And then I take it to Largo, and it's my night and my audience. And they really tell me what works and what doesn't. And by the time I have an hour after years of that, then I take it on the road.
Yeah, I think something that is kind of underrated about the process for comedians, we had Roy Wood on when Louis C.K. was in big trouble. And I think he had started doing dates and people were recording and then putting it out. And Roy just said something I'd never thought about, which was he's trying to figure out the tone of these jokes. Like, some of them are not going to work, but you can only figure out the tone when you get there. And that to me is such a unique characteristic, I think, about doing comedy is that, yeah, so Kevin Durant might show up at an open run playing basketball with some dudes, but he's going to be Kevin Durant and he's still going to like dominate. Your favorite comedian might show up at some club and be awful, not because he's awful, but because they're still figuring it out. Like, you get the opportunity in these places to watch somebody figuring it out. And I always feel like that takes an amazing level of confidence, especially if you're an established person, to know that you're going to come out here with something that is half finished and you really don't have any way around it.
No, it is tough. It's humiliating. And I've seen people who are amazing at it, like Chris Rock will just stand on stage with like his hand on the back of his neck, just looking at the ground, thinking, what else? And it doesn't care what the audience is bored or that they're waiting. I mean, they're still watching Chris Rock, but he is so patient with how he finds things on stage that, yeah, it is tough. And there's only one way to find out. You have to get in front of an audience and they tell you right away if you're right or if you're wrong.
So what's your approach to handling it when you bomb? Because that was another illuminating thing for you to realize is everybody bombs and it doesn't even really stop as you get older.
Mm-hmm. Oh, not at all. And especially, you know, as you get a reputation, it's like it's almost these built up expectations. But luckily, my character is such a villain and I have no plan B. I've never had a plan B where it's like, well, if these jokes don't work, I can talk about the local scene and make some cute jokes. No, it's like we're going to bomb with this all the way. Like I'm a movie and I can't change the movie, you know, because you're not liking it. So when I bomb, I just kind of put my shoulder into it and become even more of a villain and say, well, you're going to hate this next one. If you didn't like that one, this one is really going to make you mad. And that's fun. It's a fun way to go about doing it.
How surprised are people to find out that you're a fairly nice guy in real life?
Very surprised. Very, very surprised. And I always say I'm not even that nice. I'm just not as mean as you think I'm going to be. But I do have a resting face, as they like to say. So I just look unapproachable. But if you come and talk to me, it's like, oh, you're completely different from that character. And we get it.
Oh, we're living the same life.
People are always the word.
We're living the same life. Like, I'm a little nicer than people think. It's just the face I got if I don't know you.
I think you don't have a resting face. You have a resting, like, what the are you talking about? Like, you have, like, I love watching you, and like I love your cadence and the way you give your opinions. I love the way you deal with people on Twitter. It's just like you have like a no bullshit vibe that you were always giving off, that I can see that being intimidating.
I insist that people understand that I am actually a regular person, right? Like, and while also acknowledging that I'm not quite a regular person, but I think that when you become a visible person, you stop being a person, you become an avatar, right? Like, when people are screaming at me on Twitter, they're screaming at the screen, right? Like, they're not actually screaming at a person. I'm like, no, I'm actually right here. Like, I am the person that is behind this. Every now and then, people just need a little reminder that, you know, the bear at the zoo will bite you.
Yeah. And that's when I get into trouble, because people know my comedic persona. So if I say something wildly inappropriate or offensive, I get a pass. But if I actually give my real opinion on something as a human being, people lose their minds. People get upset and they say, oh, you're virtue signaling, you're doing this for clout. It drives me crazy that I can't really actually give my honest opinions most of the time. Even though I don't care what my fans think or what other people's fans think, I'm going to be me. You kind of get trapped in that persona at certain points because people want you to be who they think you are.
Yeah, like, I wonder that with Stephen Colbert, as he got out of the Colbert Report persona, and, you know, his views are in line with what, you know, the persona made it very clear what his views were and all of that stuff. But I still also think that there are times where he just might not want to be the person that is doing those things, but you are permanently Stephen Colbert, the Colbert Report.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, you can get trapped inside the character. And there were people who were very liberal who watched the Colbert Report and got the joke. And people who were like Bill O'Reilly fans who did not get the joke and still watched it and were entertained, which I think is hilarious. That's when you know satire is really working.
Yeah, I want Colbert to create an alternate personality called Tyrone, because his middle name is Tyrone, which I think is just the most amazing.
Is it?
Yes, his middle name is Tyrone, and I need to know how that happened.
Yeah, I would love to hear that. Get him on here.
Yeah, like, and I had an Irish friend who explained to me that, you know, over there, Tyrone is just a name, and so they have no idea. Like, I want to know when the point was when our Irish brothers in America were like, fine. Y'all can have it. Tyrone is yours. We have given this up. Tyrone belongs to you guys. Man, so you mentioned getting back out and looking like tour's about to get started. You got anything lined up in that direction, or are we just kind of pointing toward there?
No, I mean, I really get everything perfected here in Los Angeles before I take it on the road. If you're buying tickets to see me, I'm not up there screwing around trying things out. I do that all in LA. So I'll get 45 minutes hopefully by this time next year. I'll go to clubs for a while, and by the end of that club run, I'll have an hour, and then I go to theaters and do it for a year or two, and then sell the special, record the special, and then start from scratch again.
How do you enjoy LA?
I like it enough. I mean, for what I do, you have to be either in LA or New York. And I came to LA after New Orleans because I thought I can live on no money better in LA than I can in New York.
Right.
And eventually, after 7 years, went to New York for a few years, loved it there. But it was almost like college, where after 3 or 4 years, I was like, it's time to go. You know, I'm sick of my tiny apartment. I was on the road so much that coming back to LA, I enjoy the weather. I enjoy having a bigger place, more room. And I really do enjoy the clubs here. I want to be around good competition. You know, I want people, and not that comedy's a competition, but I want to be on the shows with the best of the best. And you can do that here.
I tell you, if I ever go back to LA, I did not live in LA, which was a hard lesson to learn. I lived in Claremont for a couple of years for school, and I thought I was going to LA, and I learned that I was going to Claremont, which is a much different situation. But I did an interview with Aaron Magruder once, and I asked him how he felt about LA, and his line was, well, you got to remember, the number one industry in LA is fiction, so you just can't be surprised when people lie to you. And that is the thing I feel like they should tell everybody before they show up to LA. Like, look, they're going to lie to you, just so you know. Because I find liars to not be so problematic if I know it on the front end.
Yes. You figure it out pretty quickly when things just don't appear. When they're like, you're going to do this, and then you never hear from them again. I would always say the difference between New York and LA, especially amongst comedians or just regular people, is if you talk to someone in LA and you say, hey, what's going on? They're like, well, I've got a meeting this week with a manager. I'm pitching this TV show in a month. I've got some shows. If you ask someone in New York what's been going on, they tell you about a movie they just saw. They tell you about the parents coming to town. You know, they act like real people, where in LA, everything really is about the business, and that's it.
Yeah, like it's like what Steel was to Pittsburgh. That's what movies and all this stuff are to LA. Like it's hard to, it is the industry that drives the place, right? So it's easy to think of it as Hollywood, and you know, you get to see it and all this stuff. But it's another thing when you really consider that this whole animal is fueled by all this madness. A great big old thing that don't make no sense.
Mm-hmm. And mediocrity can shoot straight to the top. Like there is no, you're not in line based on talent or what you've done. It's can you sell tickets? What can you do for me? That is strange. I mean, I don't have a lot of friends that are outside the industry, but you kind of learn how to deal with it.
Yeah, friends outside the industry have got to be, for you, like for me, they're essential. Like I'm not in even the same industry, but it's so essential to have people who look at what you do and can appreciate the absurdity more from the outside. Because once you're in it, all of a sudden this becomes your life.
Yes. Yes. So yeah, having friends on the outside, being friends with regular people is very important to keep you grounded. Because if all your friends are in the movie business, you are insane.
All right, now that is Anthony Jeselnik, who ain't no yinzer, just to make sure that everybody knows this. Check him out. Check him out on Netflix. If you can't find some of the clips of the Jeselnik offensive, check those out, because I just think those are absolutely amazing. And look, we worked like 2 years to make this interview happen for everybody. So I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. And check out the podcast I have with Greg Rosenthal, JRVP, wherever podcasts are sold.
Yeah, I need to check that. If for no other reason, then I don't know Greg well, but I'm imagining the merger of your personalities. And that was one I would not have seen coming. Like, I think I saw you guys tweeting back and forth. I was like, huh, this doesn't make a lot of sense. And now it adds up.
We started this podcast at the NFL Network, and he almost got fired every week because of it. And then they booted us out. We're at a different place now. But he's always on the verge of getting canceled because of something I've said.
Hey, man. And ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing 3 times a week. Gabe Bassain and Dave Presley handle everything behind the scenes. Thank you, gentlemen. Remember, follow The Right Time. Rate us. Review us. Give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. We'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or follow on the ESPN app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.